Bowl feature, an auditory deep dive.
For decades now, millions of European citizens have been campaigning for toxic pesticides to be banned from our fields. It's a move that would protect the health of agricultural workers and consumers and halt the dramatic decline in biodiversity. It seemed as if the European Union had really understood those calls for action and that they were about to slash pesticide use by 50%. But then came the war in Ukraine. In this podcast series, we embark on a months-long investigation. Silent Spring, Part 2, The Pesticide Lobby in Times of War.
Back in the EU district of Brussels, I get talking to someone on the street about the planned cut in the use of pesticides.
Do you think it would be good to reduce pesticides?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's chemicals, right? So, I don't know, reducing the amount of chemicals that we have in our food, it would, in my opinion, be a good thing.
The young woman starts to look a bit pensive as she watches the trams passing by and the rush hour traffic here in the center of Brussels.
Why, as a citizen, it would be good to have less pesticides, because it affects all of us. It's like an ecosystem, right? So, yes, of course, for biodiversity, but I mean, as a citizen, that's a weird thing. So to put it back to the individual, I don't think that, like, an individual can do very much about it. It's obviously something that goes through, like, laws, and we don't really have, like, we don't have much of a say in that, so okay, thank you.
Eleanor, who's out taking her dog for a walk this summer's morning in Brussels, expresses a feeling shared by many people at the moment. Why should it be down to European citizens to come up with the solutions here? Don't we have institutions in the European Union and in member states that are meant to deal with such important issues? Parliaments, which make laws, and governments and authorities who are responsible for implementing them. For decades now, Europeans have been urging their politicians to actually deliver by means of civil society campaigning, demonstrations, and petitions signed by millions of people. And last but not least, the European Court of Justice, CJEU, also called for more transparency in pesticide studies in its judgment. But are the institutions now living up to their responsibilities? Are they drawing on the very latest cutting-edge research and science during the approval process to identify the possible risks posed to environment and humans? Many people are dissatisfied, impatient in the meantime, because they've been waiting for things to change for so long, and because most people have realized that the one thing that we don't have any more of is time. So what exactly is the holdup? For answers to these questions, I'm going to meet Nina Holland from Corporate Europe Observatory, or CEO for short. It's a lobby watchdog that has a good idea of what is going on behind closed doors in Brussels. The NGO is usually very well informed about the strategies that companies keep coming up with to get what they want. Nina Holland told me that they have ample evidence to show that lobbyists are doing their utmost to stop the use of pesticides being reduced.
So last week we published our report, which we called A Loud Lobby for a Silent Spring. It's also 60 years ago that Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring was published. So this is a little tribute to her. And basically, one of the key documents that we expose in this report is a leaked social media strategy from the pesticide lobby group CropLife Europe.
That's quite a scoop, and a very revealing one at that. After all, CropLife is the most influential international pesticide lobby group. It includes the biggest industry players.
Pretty powerful, or? I mean, it's all pesticides.
Yeah, it's really clear what they intend to do. They have quite an elaborate social media strategy.
It's pretty clear what they're trying to achieve with their sophisticated social media campaigns, she says. Nina Holland starts typing away. She wants to show me the leaked documents on her laptop.
Open the link to the document from CropLive,
yeah,
is
so
that
here,
correct?
Here you see the PowerPoint presentation that was leaked, which has a slide outlining all the important files that they are working on. Well, as you can see, it's a long list. And the EU Farm to Fork files are on top. So they are clearly the most important. And what you then see is that amplifying the impact assessment, this study of impacts that they financed, that they commanded from the Wageningen University, should be amplified and to build surround sound and pressure. Mm-hmm. That is one thing that they list as a focus area.
What's the aim of this PR campaign?
Objective is no uniform mandatory pesticide reduction targets at the member state level. Guarantee workable pesticide reduction targets in each member state.
It's not clear in this context what the Agrochemical Trade Association sees as workable reduction targets. So Nina Holland inquired.
And I have asked by email to Bayer, like, what are realistic, workable pesticide reduction targets for you? What would you say, yes, we can agree to this? And they never replied.
The German multinational Bayer is also a member of the lobby group CropLife.
The head of CropLife Europe said, we are willing to discuss pesticide reduction targets as long as they are science-based.
Science-based might sound good at first. It suggests clear-cut facts and objectivity. But in fact, the term is just a front for a PR idea to influence how the public sees the scientific debate. The concept has been repeatedly brought into play ever since the launch of the new, now abandoned, TTIP trade negotiations between the European Union and the US. The intention is to undermine the precautionary principle, as Nina Holland explains. At first, Holland says she was a bit baffled by their campaign, and then shaken by its audacity.
For a long time, it was not very clear what they meant with science-based, because there's so much science backing up the need for pesticide reduction, right?
Nina Holland scratches her head quizzically. It didn't take long before the CropLife PR people's motives became clear.
But it came down very bluntly that they want the EU to take into account the economic impacts, and that is science-based. So they order these studies from universities showing with very partial figures negative impacts on, for instance, productivity with a very biased methodology. And then they will say, well, if you take that into account, then we have a science-based target, which, of course, is not science-based, it's political. It's like, what is actually your goal here? What's the political goal? Is it long-term sustainability of food production and food security, food sovereignty? Or is it short-term profits for companies?
I take a closer look at two pretty crass examples. One study investigates the economic effects of the farm-to-fork strategy in the European Union. It was commissioned by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and says the strategy would significantly reduce the EU's gross domestic product. The USDA study says it would even lead to a big rise in world hunger.
The U.S. says 185 million more people would go hungry.
In addition, the US study forecasts
that it would lead to price rises of over 17%. European exports would drop by 20%.
A German university has also taken part in studies that were funded by interest groups linked to the agricultural industry. A study published by the University of Kiel, or CAUL for short, was funded by Germany's Grain Club, a lobby association that describes itself as representing the grain and fodder industry. That analysis of the European Green Deal and the farm-to-fork strategy concludes that they would lead to a significant decline in the EU's agricultural output.
The study's author, Professor Christian Henning, suspects it would lead to a 20% reduction in grain production.
And he forecasts that this would lead in turn to hefty price rises.
It would be accompanied by price rises for agricultural produce in the European Union, including almost 60% for beef, some 50% for pork, more than 30% for raw milk, as well as between 10 and 20% for fruit and vegetables, oilseeds and grain. These are the findings of a study published today by Professor Christian Henning, Professor of Agricultural Politics and Director of the Institute of Agricultural Economics at the University of Kiel, on behalf of the Grain Club Alliance and other associations.
At this point, however, there's no further explanation of just who is behind the Grain Club. It's hard to understand why a German university would take part in studies paid for by lobby organizations. It certainly does not do much to promote public trust in academic freedom and independence in a very sensitive field of policy. So why are such interest groups and the U.S. Department of Agriculture so openly and aggressively trying to prevent green agricultural reform in Europe? I ask Nina Holland what she thinks.
Are they so afraid of this farm-to-fork strategy?
Looks absolutely, like absolutely, because it's a 53 billion industry worldwide. And if the EU market would be cut in half, the EU is one of the biggest markets for pesticides, would be cut in half, that would be a major, major loss. But they're also afraid of the global impact of the farm-to-fork strategy, because the Commission has said we also want to have an impact internationally. We will engage in what they call green diplomacy, and we will work with trade partners around the world for them also to reduce pesticides, so that globally we will have a more biodiversity-friendly agriculture, and so that also imports that we get in the EU contain less residues of toxic pesticides. And that is deeply worrying the US, that basically wants to keep countries aligned with them and with industrial agriculture using lots of chemical inputs.
But the green diplomacy that the European Commission has been dreaming of currently shows little sign of becoming reality. Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, things have actually crunched into reverse gear. I asked Nina Holland to tell me more.
It's even worse than I expected.
Safety regulations for agricultural products are being lifted at a speed that seems barely conceivable, Nina Holland explains.
I had not immediately expected that also temporarily, but still, certain food safety measures like residues in imports from potentially hazardous pesticides would just be lifted, would just be increased, so that we can be exposed to more pesticides in imports. For instance, I would not have expected that to happen so quickly. So it's even worse. But at the same time, that is what happens in a crisis. Decisions get taken very fast, and those with the best connections, they can really benefit from the speed of events and the general sense of crisis and panic that that are now predominant among decision makers. Which in the context of a war is not so strange. Eh? But still, it's extremely worrying that it seems to be benefiting industry again more than the public interest.
Food prices have in fact risen sharply in the months after the Russian invasion. But nevertheless, many people who aren't currently struggling are still coming to the market to buy fresh produce and enjoy the pleasant atmosphere.
I have a big choice of everything. I can walk around once. Well, I'm coming here for many years, so I know all of the stands here. But I can walk around once and look, and you know, this is the best one. Dennis has the best choice because there are no pesticides. You can see the dirt hanging on the carrots sometimes, and this is what I love. They come from the ground, actual ground, you know.
But in general, public trust in the food we eat is sinking. Just half of the people who took part in a recent survey believe that food in Germany is safe.
Some 50% of those canvassed in August 2022 classed food as safe with regard to health risks, while in 2021 it was still 52%, the German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment, BFR, found.
Yet the representatives of the agrochemicals industry are constantly stressing how safe their pesticides are. They insist that few other substances are tested so frequently and comprehensively. But what has actually happened since the license of glyphosate, the most important broad-spectrum herbicide, was last renewed? The herbicide is still widely used in conventional farming. It's sprayed on some 40% of fields in Germany, so it has a pivotal role in proposed pesticide reduction targets. I'm in the train on my way from Berlin to Brandenburg, the largely rural state that surrounds the German capital. It's in the middle of summer, but all the fields look browny-gray. Many of the cornfields have only grown waist-high because of drought. The maize plants are far too small for this time of year. Climate change is already making its mark. Flat, arid fields stretching as far as the eye can see. A monotonous, largely monocultural landscape. I hardly see any bushes, trees, or strips set aside for wildflowers. Let's remember, the massive use of glyphosate also leads to a loss of biodiversity. That has been sufficiently proven. The critics of industrialized farming say a ban on glyphosate would rapidly improve the situation. More than 5 years have passed since the scandal surrounding the renewal of the approval of the use of glyphosate in Europe. Are the licensing authorities like the European Chemicals Agency, ECHA, and the European Food Safety Authority, EFSA, finally moving towards improving the licensing process? Have they learned from past mistakes? I'm about to meet someone who's bound to know.
Peter Clausing?
Yes.
Hey, how are you doing? You're good?
Fine.
Okay, so we have to take a car, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, so It's 5 minutes or what? Something like that? Okay.
Peter Clausing works for the pesticide action network PAN Germany. In 2010, PAN and Greenpeace took the European Commission to court in a bid to force them to reveal the data from industry studies about glyphosate. In 2016, PAN won the case at the European Court of Justice.
So tell me your name, who you are, where are we at?
My name is Peter Clausing. We are sitting in our house, and I'm a toxicologist working for the Pesticide Action Network in Germany.
This year, Clausing is once again an independent observer at ECHA, and he is prepared to talk to me about his experiences. He is there when the authorities discuss whether to renew the licenses or substances like glyphosate, or decide to take them off the market. Representatives of the agrochemicals industry also take part in these meetings. Observers are permitted to express their opinion, but they do not have a vote. Peter Clausing puts down his cup of coffee and starts to tell me what has happened that day.
So today was an interesting day. So there was a video call or a Zoom call about glyphosate. What's going on? Maybe you can tell us something.
There was a video conference of the Risk Assessment Committee of the European Chemicals Agency. And for their sessions, they allow observers.
Okay.
And I participated as an expert because a European organization had invited me, and they have a permanent seat as an observer there.
Okay, interesting. And so do you think glyphosate will be renewed or it will be not allowed? What the ECHA will say? What do you think? What's your guessing?
My impression is they stick to exactly the same assessment as they did in 2017. Okay. Which means that glyphosate will not be classified neither for gene toxicity, nor for carcinogenicity, nor for reproductive toxicity.
So it's not dangerous, it's not causing cancer, that's what they think? Or is it...
From their perspective, it is harmless and it can be used without any restrictions.
That means in the future it can be used with no limits, or?
Yeah, that's at least from the perspective of the risk assessment of the chemicals agency.
But that might be frustrating, or? I mean, sitting here knowing better, or what do you think? You are frustrated?
This is very frustrating, in particular because the arguments are so outrageous and... they use these scientifically invalid arguments to get their thing done.
For the toxicologist Peter Clausing, this decision contradicts his scientific know-how. A risk assessment, after all, draws on toxicological experiments, research with clear indicators and findings. Yet he concedes despondently that he's almost been expecting the decision to go this way. As an independent observer, he recently attended many meetings of the European Chemicals Agency, ECHA, but he's not permitted to vote. In his opinion, a lot of dubious industry studies were deemed admissible. Results were misrepresented and warning indications, as once before in 2017, were again negligently ignored, as he explains. I ask him for more details.
In 2017, it was a scandal. A lot of science evidence was criticized or was not clear, and they used it. Maybe you can give us a little bit of details. What was used in 2017? Mm-hmm. What was criticized in 2017 mm-hmm. as scientific evidence?
Let me first say that we are talking about carcinogenicity assessment. They used the same 5 mouse studies and 7 rat studies as in 2017. And because the studies were the same, we also saw the same effects, which are increased incidences of certain tumors in each and every study. Mm-hmm. So if this was by coincidence, you would expect a spontaneously increased tumor incidence of one tumor in one study, of another tumor in the other study. But in our case, we had up to 3 of the 5 mouse studies with the same tumor increased in different mouse strains in different studies. So this is a very strong argument.
So the alarm rings are belling or not?
Yes. To me, the data are very convincing, also to others, including the IARC, and the arguments used by the ECHA are just ridiculous.
But 2017, you did something. You filed lawsuits against mm-hmm. them, you tried to defend your argument, and how was it? What happens to that lawsuits?
Mm-hmm. Well, in 2017, the rapporteur member state was Germany, or a German authority called BFR mm-hmm. as an acronym. And a number of NGOs, pan-Germany participating, filed a criminal complaint against the BFR and also against Monsanto. And they even did not accept this complaint in Germany, but they started investigations in France and in Austria. But as such things happened, they at the end were tabled or put away. And so nothing happened with regard to our complaint about scientific fraud, because we saw the data were abused, and this was the basis for our complaint.
In the case of glyphosate, the higher court, the high court decided that they become open to the public, and we got around 60 of these reports, and we could look into them, we could check their quality. Now, the regulations, the rules how the individual test systems are performed are documented in international guidelines. In the US, it's EPA guidelines, and in Europe, it's the so-called OECD guidelines. So they are a framework of quality criteria, including statistical evaluation, which has to be fulfilled. Otherwise, the tests are not reliable.
That's Professor Siegfried Knasmüller. I reach him by phone at the Center for Cancer Research at the Medical University of Vienna. Like all studies submitted by pesticide manufacturers in the approval process, the 53 genotoxicity studies that have now been analyzed were kept under lock and key for decades. But in March 2019, a European Court of Justice ruling made it mandatory for the European Food and Safety Agency, EFSA, to disclose such studies upon request. That enabled the professor to obtain those studies and carry out an independent scientific evaluation of their methodological standards. The ruling also made it possible for him to assess whether they complied with the binding OECD guidelines for tests used to fulfill the pesticide registration data requirements.
Now, we had the chance to look into approximately 60 of these tests, and we were highly surprised that we saw that only a small fraction of these tests fulfilled the current criteria. They, in other words, most of them were unreliable. They were done in such a way that you could not say this is a solid and firm result. And that was shocking for us. I also want to say that the same tests were classified and evaluated by officials of the PFR and so on, and they judged these tests as reliable. And that was a big surprise for us.
What flaws did you find in those studies? Can you give me a few examples of how they failed to meet the OECD's regulations?
To give you some example for the most frequent mistakes, statistical analyses were done inadequately. The number of animals which was used was not sufficiently high. In many cases, the cell numbers which was evaluated were by far too low. Instead of 2,000 cells, only 500 cells were evaluated. Sometimes the positive controls were inadequate or gave results which were not acceptable.
The genotoxicologist was also critical of how dated the test procedures were.
Moreover, the tests which were used to evaluate the genotoxicity of glyphosate were, in the vast majority of cases, very old. They are still in operation, but they are 30 years old or older.
Yet the OECD's rules are, in fact, very precise in this respect. EFSA responded to the criticism when Knasmüller's study was published, denying that OECD regulations had not been adhered to in the evaluation process. The European Food and Safety Agency, EFSA, had accepted 45 of these studies as sufficient evidence of the absence of genotoxicity, and 6 others as providing supplementary evidence. And in November 2015, it had come out in favor of renewing glyphosate's license. But the cancer expert, Professor Knasmüller, had further issues with the industry studies.
They submitted 17 or 18 tests. They were all negative, and there is no doubt that the compound is negative in the bone marrow. So I have no problem with that.
But he does question how much the genotoxicity testing of glyphosate using bone marrow can really tell us.
But this specific test, to which a high predictive value is given by the authorities, is very unreliable. It's more than 30 years old, and the overall evaluation of the validity of the test with more than 500 carcinogens shows that the test detects only 5 to 6 out of 10 carcinogens. So it's very unreliable, but still very often used. Now, what I want to mention in context of glyphosate is there is indication from 4 publications in journals, in scientific journals, from universities, that the compound causes DNA damage and genotoxicity in organs other than the bone marrow. There is 2 studies showing that human-derived liver cells, cells from the human liver derived, are sensitive and that the compound causes DNA damage in this cell.
So what you would suggest is that we would use for the regulation of pesticides and chemical compounds the more modern methodology, the more modern science to find out how dangerous are these compounds really are. Is that what you suggest?
in particular, if there is a data situation as we have it for glyphosate, then I would say it is mandatory to use these techniques. When you have already a clear indication from the published literature, you cannot ignore this. And as I said before, the IARC classification indicated that the experts from IARC, in contrast to the experts from EFSA and so, said glyphosate is very likely genotoxic. And they also integrated, in contrast to the EFSA authority, they included also experiments with fishes, with reptiles, with amphibians. They said, we don't need this data.
And Knasmiller has a very urgent plea, also motivated by his own studies on the mouth and nasal cells of humans. He says that newer and better tests must be carried out. Really, after all these scandals, we owe it to consumers to scrutinize the pesticide with more modern test procedures. Knasmiller cannot understand why the European licensing authorities are striving to renew glyphosate's approval for use, given the existing data. At least the EFSA has asked for more time for consideration. It aims to present its final decision to the public by June 2023. At a weekly market in Berlin, I get chatting. This market goer has just read an article about how much profit Bayer is making with products containing glyphosate in the FAZ, one of Germany's most important daily newspapers. She can't believe the news and is frustrated.
Bayer hat Riesengewinne mit Glyphosat.
Ja, großer Artikel in der
FAZ. Genau.
So the company first faces a lot of court cases because of these products. And then it makes these kind of profits. I don't understand the world anymore. Do you? Well, that's how I feel, at least. If there are now more wild animals in the city than in the country, something must be wrong, mustn't it? Yes, it's bewildering. I think people don't really think about it. And the decision makers, they don't need to buy this food. They have enough money to buy organic produce. Let the stupid plebs buy the stuff contaminated with glyphosate. That's how I read the situation. It's brutal.
Berlin Wilhelmstraße. This venerable late 19th century building houses part of Germany's Federal Ministry of Agriculture. The Greens have been in charge of the ministry since 2021.
Silvia Bender, Staatssekretärin im BMEL, wo wir auch.
In the coalition treaty, we set down that glyphosate should be banned, or that we should phase out the use of glyphosate. That means for us, as the federal government, that we are working flat out to stop the renewal of glyphosate's license. The schedule has now, let's say, slipped a bit, because the decision was meant to be reached in Brussels at the end of 2022. But it has now been postponed until 2023. Because the EFSA has not yet come to its final evaluation.
Sylvia Bender is a state secretary in the ministry and an agricultural expert.
We will use this time now to find allies at the European level who are fighting just like us to ban this substance. The effects of glyphosate on biodiversity are devastating in many places. And because it is a broad-spectrum herbicide, it's obvious that it kills everything when it's deployed. And that's why it's so important to phase out this substance. That's why I think that biodiversity arguments are on our side. And I hope that we can persuade enough member states to take this position.
And if you don't, are there theoretically also possibilities that Germany could go its own way, or would that be difficult?
We would definitely check all options to see if we could pursue our own path. Because, of course, we will ultimately be judged on whether this government keeps its promise in the coalition treaty or not. It won't be an easy path, and I can't yet promise whether it will succeed or not. But we will definitely have to try. Silent Spring Part 2, The Pesticide Lobby in Times of War. A three-part Böll special from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. This was a podcast created by Peter Kreisler. The commissioning editor was Lena Luig. It was translated and spoken by Julie Gregson and Warner Poland. With music from Zoe Kating and sound mixing by Monobeat. You can find all Heinrich Böll Foundation podcasts on your preferred podcast app. Subscribe to our podcast and spread the word. If you have any comments or feedback about this podcast, please email us at podcast@boell.de.